Hi, this is John with a few very quick announcements. First, an update on the Mormon Stories fundraising campaign, since a few of you have asked about it. I'm a little over halfway where we need to be in monthly subscribers to be able to continue Mormon Stories at its current level past July 2010. So let me both thank all of you who have signed up as a monthly subscriber and encourage any of you who haven't yet to please consider doing so. All donations are tax deductible and will go directly to the time and materials used to produce the podcast. Second, registration for the two Sunstone workshops I'm holding on August 4th is now up. The morning session is entitled How to Navigate an LDS Faith Crisis In or Out of the Church, and the afternoon session is entitled How to Navigate a Marriage When One of You Loses Their Testimony. Hopefully some couples will be able to attend that. All the information you need to register can be found at mormonstories.org. I hear that registration is filling up fast, so please register soon if that's something you want to attend. Third, I've decided to record the entire workshop and make the proceedings available to all Mormon Stories monthly subscribers as a thank you for your support. So I'm hoping that might encourage a few more of you to support Mormon Stories if you are able, again at mormonstories.org. And finally, if any of you are interested in joining the Mormon Stories private internet forum to converse with other like-minded Mormons, please send me an email via Facebook and I'll make sure you get added. Whew, that was a lot of announcements. Thanks for your patience. And now on with the show. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm John Dillon, your host, and I'm very excited to have with us today Dr. David Bailey, who is going to talk with us about a wide number of topics, but specifically today we are going to be talking about science and religion, science and Mormonism, and science and faith within the LDS Church. So we're going to cover a lot of ground. It's going to be very exciting and informative, I predict. But before we jump in, I'd like to give David Bailey a bit of an introduction. He is a graduate of both Brigham Young University and Stanford University with a PhD in mathematics from Stanford. He works as the chief technologist for the Computational Research Department at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California. He's a member of several professional societies, has received several major awards in the field of science and mathematics and computations and computers. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And he is the author of several books and articles within his field of computational and experimental mathematics. And even more interestingly, he is the founder of a very interesting and fascinating website called Science Meets Religion. You can find it at sciencemeetsreligion.org. And a lot of what we talk about today is going to come from that website, and specifically the LDS section of that website. And I guess I could say, David, that you've been involved in sort of Mormon intellectual discussions for many, many years. True?
Yes. Like, yes, I hope so for a very long time, because that's always been a great interest of mine.
So have you been involved in Sunstoner Dialogue in the past?
Sure.
Talk a little bit just about, just at a high level, what your involvement's been.
Well, I've written at least a couple of published articles that have been published in some LDS academic journals. And I've just been involved in some discussion forums on science and religion. And I think perhaps even more importantly, I've tried to field a lot of questions and discussions with individuals on a one-on-one basis, trying to help them understand a little bit better, at least the way I see these issues.
Okay, perfect. And are you comfortable talking about your status with the LDS churches? Because I think for many of our listeners, and specifically those who have requested you, or someone like you, there are many people who are struggling with their faith or belief or commitment to the church because they feel like there's some inherent contradiction between their affection or affinity for science and their belief. And I think your status with the church will be specifically or especially relevant for people like that. So are you comfortable talking about that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a fifth generation LDS, and I've always been an active and member, and I am now, and not the slightest bit hesitant to say so. I'm actually descended from the second convert to be baptized in the British Isles. It was one Henry Clegg. Some listeners may be familiar with a famous race to the River Ribble, which was two early converts, just a couple of weeks after the LDS apostles first landed in England. Converts decided they would have a foot race to see who would be baptized first. And one fellow won the foot race. He was 25 years old. The fellow that lost the foot race was 52. But I'm descended from the 52-year-old that lost the race.
Ah, hopefully your ancestors have recovered from that loss.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, I guess we've got a lot to cover tonight, but I think it makes sense to at least start with a bit of your background, especially as it relates to science and the church. So would you mind? I mean, we could probably talk for a long time about your upbringing, but maybe you could talk about your early love for science and for the church, and how those things had an interaction leading up to your decision to study mathematics and get a PhD, and if there's any interesting stories or dynamic there, and if you can talk a little bit about the environment regarding science during those formative years for you within the church.
Well, I guess that was pretty easy because where I grew up, actually close to Brigham Young University, and I knew several LDS faculty. In fact, my father was bishop, and both of his counselors were professors at the university. I think one was in math, and the other was in math and chemistry. And there were several other professors nearby. Hugh Nibley actually lived in our ward.
Oh, wow.
And so I got to know them quite well. And particularly once after I was enrolled at BYU, I had the opportunity to work as a research assistant with a professor in the physics department. And we had numerous discussions, and including the issues like about science and religion and evolution. And I quickly discovered that this was just no issue at all to him or to any of these other people that I talked to. And I just, you know, it was basically I grew up assuming there was just no real issue, and kind of surprised here and there when I discovered, say, like in when I was on a mission and talking to some other missionaries, that some thought there was an issue, because to me it didn't really seem like there was any grounds for particular conflict.
So in your church experience, Sunday school, priesthood, whatever, you never felt like growing up you received the message that science was bad, or scientists were to be feared, or intellectuals were scary, or evolution was of the devil, or anything like that?
I heard some comments like that here and there, but they were more than drowned out by positive comments from people that I respected.
In your ward?
Even in my ward, yes.
Okay. So you grew up in Provo in a very science-affirming environment.
That's right.
And I know we want to be sensitive about identity and stuff. Can you describe at all the decade or the time frame, or would rather not go there? Just because, I mean, historically that's important in terms of context, but only what you're comfortable saying.
Let's say I was at BYU several decades ago.
Okay, that's fine. And so I imagine that the Mormon doctrine had been published before or during, you know, this whole upbringing. And so I'm trying to reconcile, you know, I grew up in Texas in the 80s, and, you know, Mormon doctrine was almost like the Bible. Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon doctrine was almost like the Bible for those of us who are trying to study church theology and doctrine. And you know, we'll get into this more later, but that was something that weighed heavily on all our minds and informed our views of scientists and science. And it sounds like you're saying that somehow that book wasn't as influential in your circles?
Oh, I knew about it, but I also knew of people, including some of these professors that I knew at campus, that that recognized that there were deficiencies there, or the very least, that there were many LDS scientists that saw things differently. I remember hearing and reading, say, from Henry Eyring, who was this well-known chemist at University of Utah, and he was saying that the church would never require you to believe something that isn't true. I remember him saying just exactly in those words in a talk once that I heard. And so I had enough messages like that that it really just wasn't a big issue.
Really? So that's amazing, but I'm very glad to hear that, and it's very refreshing to hear that perspective. So let's say up until your mission, you were never sort of involved or aware of like major scandals or controversy that were prominent. It was more just like occasionally, generally, it was a science-affirming environment, both in the church and at BYU, and then occasionally you'd hear small little scuttles or people's opinions, but they weren't prominent because they were drowned out by the broader culture for you. Is that right?
I think that's a correct statement. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating. Because even when I went to BYU in the late 80s, it was a very different feeling for me at BYU in Provo. So we'll get to that, I guess, as we talk about it. So what did you love about science?
Oh, for me, it was just very much that it was just such a beautiful and such an orderly and such a logical system that you just couldn't help but be awestruck and reverential towards the natural world in general and the scientific laws in particular. And I would say I feel that same way today. And to me, that is the number one and overriding source of my religious beliefs, is just a tremendous reverence for the magnificence of the natural world. I think even like Albert Einstein, who I think compared to LDS people, was not in any way a conventional religious believer. He didn't take seriously the notion, say, of a personal God. But nonetheless, he frequently talked about in his writings about the beauty of the and the magnificence of the natural laws and the universe that's around us. And I would say I very much feel akin to those same sorts of same sentiment.
Okay, I can totally relate to that. Just a general awe and respect for nature, and science does a really great job of trying to understand and explain it. Did you ever, you know, as you sort of started learning the principles of science and geology and other types of things, did you ever struggle as a kid with your reading of the scripture, let's say the Bible, and any discrepancies you found there? And we'll dig more into the general discrepancies later, but did you ever have this sort of frustration or struggle with scriptures or prophetic utterances as they conflicted with what you learned in science?
In one level, no. In fact, I remember at the local schools at where I grew up there, we were taught about geology and evolution, and that I had no trouble with the basic facts. And as far as the scriptures, we read in the Book of Abraham that the six creative periods were described as days, which could be, you know, general periods of time, and this seemed to accord well with the general picture of what we saw from science. And the only real difficulties is when I would hear some other people say, quote, some of our more conservative leaders of years past, and insist that that was the way that we had to believe. And I would say when I was in graduate school one time, I was having a little bit of trouble, you know, that in other words, not with the basic principles, but with what people were telling me was what various leaders in the past had taught. And about that time, an article came out in this Dialogue publication written by the BYU biologist Dwayne Jeffrey, where he went and very carefully recounted the history of the church's approach to evolution through the years, and showed how that really it had been a generally open-minded stance for most of the way, and the one or two general authorities that taught a more fundamentalistic line, they were really more in the exception rather than the rule. And so, you know, that really sort of affirmed my basic feeling that there just really wasn't an issue. And I've told Dwayne that right to his face that I really appreciated that article, and that I'm probably in the church and faithful to this day in part because of his article.
We'll have to find a way to reference that article from the blog post. So I'll make a note of that. Is Dwayne Jeffrey still alive? Do you know?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, he's still on the faculty. I think he's in semi-retirement, but he's definitely on the zoology faculty at BYU.
Okay. Okay. So you went to graduate school and became a scientist and a mathematician.
Yep.
And ever since then, you've had a strong positive relationship both with science and the church. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, maybe then, if it's okay, let's back up. Unless there's anything else you wanted to talk about your upbringing as it relates to science and Mormonism that you think is relevant here.
No. Why don't we move
on? Okay. Okay. So, I guess it might not be a horrible place to start to just talk about what the Bible says about, you know, the earth and the science and death and Adam and Eve and the flood. And most of our listeners are going to generally know, but I think it just wouldn't hurt to quickly discuss sort of the main stumbling blocks that people have had with the Bible. I'm presuming is the biggest offender, but you can tell me if any of the other standard works are also stumbling blocks for people. But what are the major elements of the Bible that have caused people to feel like there's a conflict between science and religion, or Christianity in particular?
Well, that's pretty easy. That most people that have trouble in this area, it all derives around the scientific picture of the creation, formation, and evolution of the Earth versus what is often a very literal and reading of the scriptures. That is what people get hung up on, and in particular what they think is what the church should teaches them about the creation scriptures. And first of all, it's the time period. Of course, we know very firmly now from science that this has happened over a period of, at least for the Earth, it's about 4.5 billion years. And we see a sequence of fossils going throughout geologic history right up to the present day. And all of these fossil layers are dated with these radiometric techniques that have been polished and honed through the years, that so that that general picture is very, very solid. And so people that have difficulty here basically are very firm, are hung up on looking at the 6 days of creation and thinking that that's either six literal days or is more, perhaps even more common, is that 6,000 years. And if you really are stuck on that, then there's going to be an issue. But
now the thousand years per day thing, that's not even Mormon, right? That comes from some Middle Ages type of interpretation.
Well, there is actually one verse that I think it's in Peter in the New Testament that says one day with God is a thousand years.
Okay,
it says
okay.
Something like that. And so traditionally that has been read as not just as a metaphor of how, you know, time with God is different than time with us, but instead is a very literal statement, in particular applying to the days of creation. And so again, the real resolution of all of this is just to sit back and say, hey, just a minute. Is the primary purpose of the Bible to be a scientific textbook? And again, even the most dyed-in-the-wool literalist, I think, has to acknowledge that no, that's not really what the Bible is about at all. And it's not the primary purpose. It's not even a secondary purpose. As a statement of precise technical detail, the scriptures obviously leave something to be desired. On the other hand, as statements of what the purpose of creation is and what our role and what our position is in the cosmos, it's hard to think of any more poetically beautiful way of stating that than what we have in the scriptures. And so I think once we just step back from a very literal, very fundamentalist reading, there really is no objection. And this is what I've tried to tell people through the years, that there's only an issue if we make an issue. There's only a war if we make war.
Okay.
And does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. And just for the benefit of some of our listeners that may not know some of the major issues, I'm just going to try and summarize them really quickly. So there's what you mentioned about the literalistic interpretations of the days or the years of the age of the earth. There's, you know, the quotes about Adam and Eve and there not being any death before the fall of Adam, of animals of any kind. There's, you know, the notion that Adam and Eve were definitely the first humans on the earth, and so there couldn't have been any humans before Adam and Eve. And if you trace the genealogies in the scriptures and whatever years you can derive from the ages of people, that kind of puts Adam and Eve living around 6,000 years ago. Is that right? By those who have tried to estimate
it. You're talking like Reverend Dusher.
Right. Who's that?
Yes, Reverend Usher was this fellow that I think he was about 1600 or sometime in the 1600s that did this, worked out this chronology that's perhaps the most widely used chronology of the Bible today. And he worked out that the creation occurred in October, on a certain day in October in 4004 BC.
Right. But that was how I was raised, believe it or not, in the 1980s, to believe that.
Well, so,
anyway, so it was real to me for many, many, many years until, frankly, until I was at BYU and studied under Bill Bradshaw and you know, some other good scientists there. But the other ones that come to mind real quickly, other than, you know, the death of Adam and pre-Adamites and, no death before the fall, would be a global flood. The Bible talks about what, water covering the whole earth or something to that effect. Is that right?
Yes.
And then I guess there's a part in the Old Testament where it says the sun stood still and
that Joshua.
And that was the basis for the Catholic Church being angry at who Galileo for advancing the idea that the earth goes around the sun, because that conflicted with a literal reading of Joshua. Is that right?
Actually, it's even better. In fact, this is one thing I sometimes point out to people, that there are actually many scriptures, there are many different passages in the Bible that either explicitly state or at least presume the ancient cosmology. There's if you look through the scriptures, you'll find numerous places where it talks about the foundations of the earth. Well, in their view, it was literal foundations. The earth was based on a foundation. And there's a big dome above it. You can. This is all very well known.
Right, right.
But what's surprising is how many different verses affirm this cosmology. And so, in fact, you can ask the question: why do we insist on taking each of the creation scriptures so very literally, or even for that matter, the flood scriptures so very literally? And yet, with regard to all of these scriptures that talk about the four corners of the earth and the foundations and the firmament, which was really this dome, there's not anyone seriously that takes those scriptures literally. So, and yet there are really many more of them. So why should we take the flood or the creation scriptures so very literally, when any reasonable person would say that we shouldn't take these other scriptures literally?
Yeah, and it's one thing that I like to try and do is avoid the trap of blaming the victim. And I want to be careful using the term victim, because I think we're all agents and we all are responsible at the end of the day for what we think and believe. But you would agree that over the history of time, both within Christianity and within the LDS Church, many people have arrived at a literal reading of the scriptures through the urgings of the scriptures themselves, or through the leaders, that we read to sort of assume that by the word of the leaders or by the scriptures, that is the same voice. And so you'd agree that religious people often come by this tendency to read things literally, sort of honestly, through the urging of some of their leaders, right?
Oh, I would say so. This has definitely been an issue. I mean, for that matter, you mentioned Mormon doctrine. Very definitely, this has been a major source. Many people have read what Elder McConkie wrote, say, about evolution in Mormon doctrine, and presume that is the actual official church's view. And we don't need to go very far to find some interpretations like this. For that matter, there's even to this day, there are some that to me is frankly rather embarrassing material in the seminary manual on the Old Testament, say, like on the chapter on the creation, and also on the flood. People have complained about it, and the I have heard that the staff that puts together the manual does plan to revise that part, but nonetheless, it's there it is, and many people, you know, presume that that's what it would be, and so it's not. You're certainly correct that the people who do have those views, there are seemingly authoritative sources that they can turn to for support for those positions.
Right. Well, let's go ahead then and dive into how maybe to try and, you know, explore a little bit how the manuals ended up the way they did. And it's sort of the story for me starts back in the 1800s when the church was first founded. And I think that many people, many LDS people who have affinities for science would take heart at many of the early quotes from either attributed to Joseph Smith or directly from Brigham Young and John Taylor and others affirming, the importance and the validity of science. Can you talk and just give a brief overview? I mean, your website, and I'll refer people to it again, sciencemeetsreligion.org, under the LDS section, there's actually a section called LDS Science Quotes. And you can find, 50 really good quotes that are affirming science from, you know, Joseph Smith or Brigham Young and John Taylor, all the way through David O. McKay, Hubie Brown, even to the modern day. But just talk a bit about the types of quotes or the types of things we hear Brigham Young and others saying about the validity and the importance of science, if you will.
I think actually perhaps the person who had the most of those is Brigham Young. And he was really quite specific that in several instances that he did not see that the world of science as at war with the church. And perhaps my favorite is a discourse given by Brigham Young in 1871. And he's very explicit here. He says that, in these respects, we differ from the Christian world, for our religion will not clash with or contradict the facts of science in any particular. He even then goes and gives some specific examples. He mentions geology, and he says that it's a true science, not that he's going to endorse every precept, but that the basic facts are certainly true and are eternal. Then he goes on and he says that it's preposterous to assume that the Lord made the earth out of nothing. Nothing was ever made out of nothing. And then he goes on and he talks about the scriptures. I'm sure that would give many people who take a fundamentalist, literalist view of the scriptures would certainly squirm at this. But here's Brigham Young. He says, how long it has been organized is not for me to say, and I do not care anything about it. And as for the Bible account of the creation, we may say that the Lord gave it unto Moses, or rather Moses obtained the history and traditions of the fathers, and from these he picked out what he considered necessary, and that account has been handed down from age to age. And whether the Lord found the earth empty and void, whether he made it out of nothing or out of the rude elements, or whether he made it in 6 days or in as many millions of years, is and will remain a matter of speculation in the minds of men unless he gives revelation. So it's just really clear that Brigham Young was just completely open to modern science and did not see any point in having a battle with science.
What about Joseph? Any inklings from Joseph?
Well, really very little that is truly Joseph, as opposed to things that were once subscribed to Joseph but have more recently been found probably not. So there's really not a lot to say there. But
definitely nothing anti-science that
absolutely
you found.
Not. Absolutely not. In fact, I think that we need to really sit back and realize that Joseph Smith, right from the beginning of the first vision, he saw Mormonism as a break with the traditional Christianity, particularly its fixation on the Bible. He very clearly stated that the Bible is not sufficient. That was certainly his experience in going around all the different denominations and all the confusion that he heard, and that it was time to just set all of those different interpretations aside and really get back to basics.
But even that nothing can be created from nothing, that sounds like it comes from the lectures on faith, right? Or something to that effect?
I think that is actually in the King Follett discourse.
Okay, yeah.
The lectures in faith actually sound more like they were written by Sidney Rigdon, frankly.
Okay. And those, you know, those who have read a lot about Joseph, he just seems so expansive and inclusive in things that he experienced that it's just hard to imagine Joseph as being anti-science. That's just my own editorial comment. But okay, so from Brigham Young to, let's say, the early 1900s, would you say that Brigham Young's support or affinity towards science carried on through, you know, his successors, or at least, we didn't see a swell of anti-science sentiment in the late 1800s?
Not really, no. I mean, even like, for instance, I mean, another thing that's really characteristic of the early LDS leaders was this very, to me, that's, I think, perhaps the single most important principle that was taught in early Mormonism, namely that they saw God as acting within the realm of natural law, not utterly beyond the realm of natural law. And so, you know, with that viewpoint, indeed, that just completely obliterates any need for a war between science and religion. Brigham Young made comments like that and tried to emphasize that there really is no such thing as miracles as we normally think of. There are only principles that and laws perhaps that we don't yet understand. He also mentioned how he was trying very hard to get the saints to believe how that God is, he said, a scientific character that lives by science and strict law. And then clear into the 20th century, Talmage very, very clearly stated in the Articles of Faith, which is, again, a very widely available book. Many, many LDS people have it on their shelves. But there he says very clearly that miracles should not be regarded as opposition to the laws of nature. He says that notion is plainly erroneous, for the laws of nature are inviolable. And so all of that that continued well into the 20th century, and I don't really see that changing much. Even as we go into the middle of the 20th century, then we have issues with evolution again. But until that time, it was really pretty solidly positive.
Yeah, and I seem to recall reading that the church seemed to openly encourage its brighter minds to go off and get advanced degrees in all the major academic fields, well into the early to mid-1900s. And of course, we know that it brought into its senior ranks of leadership several scientists. True?
That's correct. Obviously, Talmage was he received a PhD in geology, and there were several other scientists in among the Quorums of the Twelve in the early part of the 20th century in particular. But you mentioned about how LDS students going out to study science. In fact, someone did a study about 1960 or 1970 and found that among practicing professional scientists, there were the people who had gotten their bachelor's in Utah were disproportionately represented more than any other state. And so, I mean, it was just very clear many had answered that call to go out and to study fields of science almost as a mission duty.
Right, right. Yeah. So given you describing the environment regarding science in your upbringing and my understanding of both, you know, 19th century Mormonism and a great deal of early 20th century Mormonism, I'm stunned at how I and many other people came to view science, you know, in, let's just say, the 1980s. And so let's start, you know, what can you tell us about the early beginnings of this anti-science or anti-evolution or anti-geology sort of movement, or movement towards literalistic readings of the scriptures? What can you tell us about its origins? And I'd want to make sure you noted the firing of the professors or BYU professors in, you know, around 1910-ish or so, if you happen to recall that. But what can you tell us about how this came to be? And then I'll guide you from there.
Well, I think it was sort of a difference between an overall positive approach to science, but this business about evolution was a source of some indigestion, and so when some of the professors at BYU were speaking positively of evolution, this kind of caused a problem with the leadership in Salt Lake, and I think this was 1911.
Okay.
And again, I think there was nothing unusual there. People at the time and much more widely in the U.S. were very reluctant to endorse evolution, at least to the extent that it was being taught in the major universities. So this perhaps is not really a matter of surprise. And of course, in 1909, there was this statement that the first presidency published. It was actually intended to kind of establish a more modern theology and get away from like the Adam God theory and some of this other speculation that had been rampant in the 19th century. But in there was this one comment that the notion of humans evolving from lower orders, that these were theories of men. And so later people started to go back and reference that passage, which was probably not really intended to be the central message of that statement. I think perhaps most clearly, though, this began with Joseph Fielding Smith, who personally very much had a problem with evolution, and even had a problem with the old Earth geology. And he actually gave a talk where he specifically discussed these theories and rejected them, and specifically rejected the notion that there were any pre-Adamites or any life before Adam.
Any idea on the approximate date of when he started talking about
that
this?
That was probably about 1930 is when that started to come up. But again, there had been discussions and there have been indications that for quite a few years, Joseph Fielding Smith in particular was of that view.
Okay, and let me just really touch briefly on this 1911 evolution controversy. I found a reference to this on a website called mormonevolution.blogspot.com, but it references a work or some writing by Gary Bergera in a book called Brigham Young University, House of Faith and the Search for Harmony, Essays on Science and Mormonism, where it talks about the 1911 evolution controversy. And basically, three professors were teaching evolution and specifically theorizing, I believe, as to the idea that maybe evolution was God's way to create mankind, or that somehow there's a connection between Adam and those that we call pre-Adamites, or men or cavemen or prehistoric men that lived before Adam. And basically, as a result, these, you know, there was a committee and a hearing that was held, and these three professors were let go. And I love this quote that I got from the equivalent to the press release. It basically said, "The wisdom of the committee and board of trustees in their actions, as well as the justice and consistency thereof, will be conceded by every right-thinking man." you know, the standard of faith and belief for all Latter-day Saints must be the word of the Lord as set forth in the Holy Scriptures. Undeviatingly should this be the case in church institutions of learning, blah, blah, blah. And it goes on to talk about how, you know, college students have fragile faith and that we shouldn't be talking about things that can lead to the disillusion of faith. And it's very much, I think, the same type of logic that sort of, you know, led to a host of behaviors by the church to maybe not be as candid with its history as it might have been, or as upfront, or as sort of publishing about some of the less, the more controversial aspects of its history that now maybe, you know, is starting to come back a little bit and bite the church as people now learn the stuff through alternative methods. But I don't want to drill too deeply into it, but I guess that was Joseph F. Smith, who was at the head of that 1911 incident. And of course, he is the father of Joseph Fielding Smith. So I guess we have to tie Joseph Fielding Smith's actions to the actions of his father, which I used to always tie to Brigham Young. But it's pretty clear that, you know, is it fair to say that Joseph F. Smith had a hostility towards science that Brigham Young didn't share? Or is that just unfair characterization overall?
I think you may be reading a bit too much in there. Again, I don't think we can read too much into any of that. That was simply a widely held view at the time, that while they were in general very positive to science, evolution was problematic. And because, again, I think in general people still wanted to, they hadn't really adjusted to this idea that maybe creation could happen through evolution. And so when this was being taught somewhat openly at BYU, that was just sort of going too far.
Okay. So,
I have never heard anything in Joseph F. Smith I think it was really Joseph Fielding Smith himself really didn't like evolution. And he obviously from his writings, he made that clear.
Yeah. Okay. So that's an important thing to note. And as I'm looking through Joseph F. Smith's writings, he wrote as an explanation, "Some of our teachers are anxious to explain how much of the theory of evolution in their judgment is true and what is false, but that only leaves their students in an unsettled frame of mind. They are not old enough and learned enough to discriminate or put proper limitations upon a theory which we believe is more or less a fallacy. In reaching the conclusion that evolution would be best left out of discussions in our church schools, we are deciding a question of propriety and are not undertaking to say how much of evolution is true or how much is false. We think that while it is a hypothesis on both sides of which the most eminent scientific men of the world are arrayed, that it is folly to take up its discussion in our institutions of learning, and we cannot see wherein such discussions are likely to promote the faith of our young people. On the other hand, we have abundant evidence that many of those who have adopted in its fullness the theory of evolution have discarded the Bible, or at least refused to accept it as the inspired word of God. So I think that just sort of affirms what you were saying, that there is a general respect for science, but when it starts to really encroach on general understandings of theology and the origins of man, that's when the brethren started getting restless.
Yeah, but it's very interesting. Even the passage you just wrote, notice how open-minded he was.
Very much,
how,
yeah.
And how very much he wanted to emphasize that he didn't want to comment on this and get involved in the scientific aspects of the theory. He just wanted to... He mainly just wanted to say, hey, let's go slow on this for the sake of our youth.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a very pragmatic and not a doctrinaire point of view, even though it was very clear that he thought it was would eventually be seen to be fallacious.
Yeah, and I just have to say, I find the writings of top church leadership in the late 19th and early 20th century as generally being very thoughtful, almost intellectual, if I dare use that term, but just extremely thoughtful, wise people generally. Is that what you found?
Yeah, I think in addition to some of the we mentioned Talmage, for instance, this actually and B.H. Roberts, both of them were very, very clear and open-minded, even on issues of relating to evolution. And I think in general they were trying to at least keep an open mind. Like B.H. Roberts, he wrote this one book that was published, his manuscript that was later published. He said, On the other hand, to limit and insist on the whole of life and death to this side of Adam's advent to the earth some 6,000 or 8,000 years ago, as proposed by some, is to fly in the face of facts so indisputably brought to light by the researcher of science in modern times. And goes on and just as eloquently and clearly as he could write to argue for an open-minded approach here and to be realistic about the basic scientific facts. And so, Talmage, in his he gave a talk in the Tabernacle that was later published by the church, where he was talking about very clearly acknowledging the antiquity of the earth and the fossil record, and that they were, you know, many biological organisms that were on the earth generation after generation before humans came around. This is all stated, I think, quite clearly. Again, Joseph Fielding Smith was one who dissented from this, and then of course, as you probably are aware, that there was this one instance in about 1930 where they had a rather public disagreement on this topic. But again, even when that happened, when the church entertained the different viewpoints, or when the first presidency entertained the different viewpoints between Joseph Fielding Smith and B.H. Roberts in particular, and also with Talmage commenting on it, what their final instruction was is this very simple statement to say, hey, let's keep out of these scientific issues. It doesn't do any good for us to involve the church and involve the church leaders in scientific disputes. There's this one passage, it says, upon the fundamental doctrines of the church, we are all agreed. Our mission is to bear the message of the restored gospel to the people of the world. Leave geology, biology, archaeology, and anthropology, no one of which has to do with the salvation of souls of mankind, to scientific research, while we magnify our calling in the realm of the church. So again, I think they're trying very hard, even though they may not like evolution and some of these topics, or maybe even not even like old earth geology, but they think very clearly saw that it was unwise for the church to involve itself either in the instruction of the church quorums or in its literature or official discourse to get mired into scientific debates.
Yeah, and I, you know, we've kind of, you kind of talked about the B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith affair and how it resolved, but there's a lot of color and interest in that whole scenario that is really fascinating and worth listening to. And I'll just reference a book maybe I'll provide a link to, but Signature Books came out with a book called The Search for Harmony, Essays on Science and Religion, edited by Gene Sessions and Craig Oberg. It's completely available online in full text form on the signaturebookslibrary.org website. And there's an essay in there that's called The B.H. Roberts, Joseph Fielding Smith, James E. Talmadge Affair by Richard Sherlock and Jeffrey E. Keller. And it's just a fascinating story to talk about. We've kind of briefly touched on it as you made your comments, but you know, let me set it up and see if you can just talk a little bit more in detail about it, because in some ways it's tragic to me. In some ways, I'm just so confused about it, because leading up to, let's just say, the 1940s and 50s, you know, the decades before that, you have B.H. Roberts, which was not an apostle, but I believe he was, you know, a high-ranking general authority. You have James E. Talmadge. You have John Widstow. You have Eyring, and you know, several major high-level church leaders who were not only scientists, not only very supportive of science, but they were actually believers in evolution. Is that right?
Well, I think we have to define evolution. They were certainly coming to accept the old Earth view. In other words, that things are a little bit older than a lot older than 6,000 years, and not completely averse to the notion that plants and animals have been evolved, as we see in the fossils, for many years. So they would have probably rejected what we currently view as evolution, meaning that the forces of mutations and natural selection are sufficient to explain the history of life. They probably would reject that, and they would probably reject the notion that humans are related to the tree of life. They still wanted to see humans as being specially created in some way, even although there were discussion back and forth about whether or not they were pre-Adamites. But I think we have to grant the point there that evolution in its modern, in the 21st century notion, would probably not have been something that they have endorsed, even though they were open to the general notion of a evolutionary development of life.
Okay. But definitely not this wholesale dismissal of evolution as satanic and evil, like we see with Bruce R. McConkie in his Seven Deadly Heresies talk, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, and here's what I don't, well, I mean, the recounting of this affair is fascinating, because you have B.H. Roberts, who's the super well-informed, you know, person who respects science, who knows a lot about science, you know, writing this, you know, 700 plus page manuscript called The Way, the Truth, the Way, and the Life, trying to find a theological, a doctrinal bridge or reconciliation
with modern science at his time, and, you know, just doing what seems to be an intellectually Herculean work to try and bridge all this stuff. And we also know that he knew about the archaeological and historical concerns about the Book of Mormon, and he tried to do his best to be open about those and reconcile them. And you've got Talmage and Woodstow and Eyring in his corner. And then you've got Joseph Fielding Smith, who is making these public and some would say mean-spirited declarations and assertions and writings, almost, what is it fair to say, attacking the character of B.H. Roberts and others, and you know, sort of in a mean-spirited way.
That's probably going too far.
Okay.
He would. I would just say that Joseph Fielding Smith just rather passionately believed that evolution was wrong, and that would eventually be refuted. I don't think. I mean, I read other areas where people saw him as actually a rather compassionate person. So I don't think we need to go further than that.
Okay. So and you know the literature more than me, so I don't know where I got that impression. So you don't think that Joseph Fielding Smith sort of framed this discussion about evolution in terms of loyalty to the church, or, you know, being right with God, or, you know, as urgently and as critically as Brigham Young or Bruce R. McConkie seemed to do later? Is that your understanding?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. So Bruce R. McConkie took it even a step further than Joseph Fielding Smith?
It's very interesting that, I mean, one of the reasons I say that we ought to be just a little bit softer Fielding Smith is when Elder McConkie's Mormon Doctrine came out, one of the first to express some concern was Joseph Fielding Smith, who was his father-in-law.
Right.
And he was concerned, I mean, for starters, that he didn't know anything about it.
Right.
He specifically said that he was completely unaware that this project was in the works, and was really uncomfortable that Elder McConkie had gone ahead with it without really getting clear endorsement from the church. And other, of course, as you know, other leaders of the church also had expressed concern. President McKay even convened this committee that included, as I recall, Marquis Peterson and one other person I can't quite remember right now, to read the manuscript and look at it. And they identified numerous problems, including specifically mentioning that the book's treatment of, it said, evolution and evolutionists. In other words, they were concerned not only with what he was saying about evolution, but with his expressions of disdain and judgment towards those who do. And so, again, I think that it's very clear that Elder McConkie was taking a step further than Joseph Fielding Smith would have been willing to go.
Okay. So I totally will defer to your understanding of Joseph Fielding Smith. And it'd probably be remiss to not mention his publishing of the book Man of Origin and Destiny, right? Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. This was in 1954. As I understand it, this manuscript, Man, His Origin and Destiny, had actually been in the works since 1930, when he was having this debate of sorts with B.H. Roberts. But here he took, in this book, he took a very literal view of the creation and a very strong rejection of the theory of evolution. It was interesting at the time that, President McKay, of course, had a much more expansive view of things, and he he certainly didn't endorse this, but in reading this, the Prince's biography of David O. McKay, it's quite clear that really his overriding thought was that he didn't want to be one that would be a president of censorship. He wanted to allow people to express themselves, even if he didn't agree with it. And so he allowed Elder Joseph Fielding Smith to go ahead with that book, just providing that it was clearly stated in the introduction that it was represented his own views. And then when people would write letters to him expressing concern, President McKay would respond with a very short statement saying that book was not published by the church and was not approved by the church and contained expressions that for which the author alone was responsible. There are numerous letters like this, but it's very clear that he didn't want to be in position to be censoring either with this or with Elder McConkie's book. And so even though like this committee had actually recommended that they stop publication of the of Mormon doctrine, nothing was really done on that. And then, of course, after later, McConkie went ahead and did reprint the book. But anyway, getting back to Man, His Origin and Destiny, I think that as much as anything is expressed his view. It was very clear what he felt, and he was also, he had thought that it was not just doctrinally wrong, but that it would be shown to be wrong scientifically as well. And obviously, history has not gone on his side. But again, I just see it as simply just a very frank and very clear statement of his views.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.